Hello, everybody. Welcome to the shit show with Jaybo. What the hell is going on with all of you? To tell you the truth, I am kind of out of it, but I'm hoping that doesn't compromise the quality of this fine podcast that you've all learned to like, at least, maybe like, maybe love. I doubt it. Hopefully you like it at least, right? I wanted to tell you guys, so a long time ago, well, first of all, I'm a little tired because I just hit the gym and I did not feel like hitting the gym, and I always feel like hitting the gym. You wouldn't know it because I'm not really in shape. I feel like under, you know, my gut, I might have a six pack, and I'm never too tired to go to the gym. But I fought through it, and it wasn't an invigorating experience at all. It was just kind of like, I just felt worse after it. You know, I was on the treadmill for 5 minutes just to get warmed up. My knees just hurt. I came to the conclusion that I don't think I drink enough water, so I bought this Gatorade, this Fierce Gatorade. It's just filled with sugar. It's very tasty. It tastes like apples, like sour apples, kind of, or at least the chemical version of that. Here, hold on. Let me grab a drink here. They say that drinking a lot of water or liquids, you know, that hydrate you will make you less hungry and give you more energy. I've never found that to be true, but I've never really tested it before. I'm horrible about drinking water. I occasionally do, but most of the time I'm just dried the fuck out and just withered like a piece of bacon, man, like a piece of dried out bacon. Anyway, I didn't get a whole lot of sleep the last two nights. I've gotten about 5 hours each night. Yeah, I get to sleep about 12:30. 1, and I'm up at 5:30. So then I drive 2 hours to my job, and it's dark, and the roads are getting weird. It's getting a little icy. Not icy yet, but it's coming. Every morning, I basically have to check my weather app on my phone and look at the two troubled towns. The two troubled towns, and feel free to look it up on a map if you're so inclined, are Ligonier, three troubled towns, Ligonier, Somerset, and Berlin, all on the way between Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and Cumberland, Maryland. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do when I see that it's actually snowing in all those places these mornings. I've been really lucky. It's like early November right now, close to mid-November, but at some point I'm going to get my fucking ass kicked, and I feel like the only solution is to drive the long way around. It's already a really long drive. I don't want to go over mountain passes that are icy or snowy. It just seems really dangerous at that time in the morning. So I'll probably go an alternate route that'll take about, I think, about 2.5 hours, but it will be all highway, and I'd much rather drive highway. Do you guys know what I mean? Thank you so much for listening to the shit show with Jaybo, and I hope you enjoyed my theme song at the start. That is a song that I wrote. It's called, you know, Welcome to the Shit Show, Baby, or whatever. It's just the shit show theme song. But it's so funny how the very first time I ever played that song, when I created it, it was totally spontaneous. It was when I was working over there at Hollow Earth Radio and back in Seattle. And I brought a tambourine, or there was a tambourine in the studio. And I literally just, the first thing out of my mouth, welcome to the shit show, baby, welcome to the shit show, baby, welcome. I know you'll be feeling home. And that's kind of all I did. But that is the basis for it. And it just came out like that. And I wrote it and I put some chords to it. And I wrote the lyric, we got a lock on all things magic and we got a lock on all things tragic. I thought that was a pretty good line. So anyway, that is me singing. It's me playing guitar and bass. And my friend Sean Ruffner put it all together. So thanks, Sean. How's everybody doing out there? Did you have an okay week? Like I said, I'm really fucking tired. I didn't sleep well. So my week's fine, though. I've been working really hard at work, trying to prove something, but I got a bunch of shit at work today. Like, the girl that I work with went to some rave party in Orlando, and she's so happy, you know? She was so happy when she was high, and when she wasn't high, she wasn't happy. Do you guys ever run into people like that where, I mean, she's great, but sometimes, you know, she comes in, I hope she doesn't listen to this. Sometimes she comes in and it's clear she's not intoxicated or something, and she's just in a bad place and just fucking takes it out on me. Today was one of those days, and I had to aggressively defend myself. And it's not because I'm thin-skinned. You know, people who, like, insult other people sometimes go, oh, that person's thin-skinned, or Donald Trump is thin-skinned, or so-and-so's thin-skinned. But the fact is, you're not thin-skinned if you merely are just defending yourself. If somebody says some rude shit to you, you can let it flow off your back, or you can defend yourself and then let it flow off your back, you know? That's not being thin-skinned. That's just defending one's self. I prefer to do that. She came in today breathing fire on me at work. Bunch of trumped-up charges, man. I swear to God, I don't even want to get into it. That's not the point of this podcast. But I didn't appreciate it. I stood up for myself. And by the end of the day, there was respect. There was a fist bump. She's my supervisor, kind of. Not really. She's the lead in the room that I grow, you know, asparagus in. And whatever. I have a bunch of bosses. And it's okay. It's pretty cool. Anyway, thank you for listening to The Shit Show with J-Bo once again. Please like us on Facebook, Twitter. Go throw me a comment, man. Tell me what you thought of the episode. I know a lot of you are downloading it. I would love to hear from you in one way or another. You know how to find me. It means a lot to me. I'm doing 52, as in an entire year, every single week for a year. And I might just retire after that. I might just retire podcasting. I've been doing it for, at that point, probably like 5 years. And if I'm not earning a living or really stoked, I'm sure I'll be stoked. I love doing it. But if I'm not, like, I don't know, I might give it up after 52 weeks. So that's a long way away. But I hope to get a massive fan base before then. And I hope to have sponsorship and get paid roughly. Let's see. How can I predict the future? What I would like paid to this podcast $10,000 per week, okay? That's roughly $520,000 a year. I could definitely live off that. To be honest, $100 a week would be fine, but I'm going to go ahead and go big and predict that. You know, I'm going to reach for the stars, the money stars. Anyway, I want to tell you guys on this particular episode, this will be the second installment of my Seattle years. Now, the first installment was 2 weeks ago, I think. Was it 2 weeks ago? I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, but I don't think it was last week, was it? No, last week I talked about Detroit. Yeah, so I went to Seattle from the ages of 20. I was barely 21, and I left when I was like 41. So 20 years, and I think I got into, you know, the drugged out Denny's trip. Go listen to that episode. It was just a couple ago. The drugged out Denny's, you know, the crystal meth amphetamine trip that made me think about joining a band and allowed. Sorry, I just got distracted. I'm in this house. I'm in my cousin's house in Cumberland, Maryland. I heard him say something. Sorry. You heard about the drug days. You heard about the crazy band Room 11 now. I'm gonna try to go from, this is gonna be one of my favorite bands of all time is Modest Mouse. If you were in Seattle from, you know, mid to late 90s, basically Modest Mouse was a force to be reckoned with. I think they're great. I think their image has kind of softened because that's what happens when bands get huge and mainstream. They kind of soften a little bit. They're still hardcores, but they were like unbelievable. Like, Isaac Brock was an unbelievable front man. And he was very, it kind of marks my late 90s years. You know, I got to got to Seattle in 97 and had that band Room 11. Like I said, listen to that episode from a few ago. But let's just start and finish this story with Modest Mouse. I was in Room 11 and I had heard about this band Modest Mouse, and I liked them because I was really into alliteration at that point. I think I recently had learned the term alliteration, and alliteration is using the same letter twice or three times to emphasize. It's like a marketing gimmick, right? Like, there was this band at the practice space called Toothpaste 2000, and then there was Modest Mouse, and I even thought of coming up with a band name, or I thought of a band name called Frog Force, to use the alliteration. But I'd heard about them, I'd wanted to see them, and one afternoon, I went down to a place called the Velvet Elvis in Pioneer Square. Now, Pioneer Square is like, if you know the movie Singles, the Seattle movie, if you think about the cover where it's Matt Dillon sitting with, what's her name? Blonde. She a daughter of a famous woman. Anyway, that's in Pioneer Square. That's exactly what it looks like. There's cobblestone streets, there's cobblestone parks, people just hang out, business types intermingle with day drunk people, intermingle with homeless people, and there's a lot of coffee shops down there. It's a pretty cool place. It's actually, it's not a cool place as far as Seattle goes, but it's solid and it's very much Seattle. So I went to this place called the Velvet Elvis, and I'd seen a Jack Kerouac play at that same place not too long before that, called The Essence of Jack, Vincent Balestri. He was really cool. I was really into beat poetry. I didn't know what to expect, but it's safe to say that Modest Mouse thoroughly blew me away. There have only been about three or four bands that I've seen live that were kind of life-changing, just seeing them live, not even knowing their music. It's one thing to go see a band and know their music. It's already formed pathways, you know, in your mind. So it's easy to kind of get into it if you really know the music. But if you don't, and a band really impresses you, I think that's something really special, because it's like an environmental situation. You know, like, your environment is changed. It's a cataclysmic event. Something just rocks you to your core. And Modest Mouse definitely did that. They were really, really young. And what I remember about that show was Isaac Brock had seemingly taken a pair of clippers to his own head, and he had a huge chunk of hair missing on the side. And he talked about how the night before he had like cut his hair drunk, and some girl was like, "It's so cute." And he told her to, like, shut up or something like that, or whatever, you know, some self-effacing comment. I remember thinking, see, this is long before, like, I think Lonesome Crowded West, their breakthrough record, had just been released, like, within a week or two, or right around there, because I got it afterwards, but it was very new, and there wasn't really a buzz as far as I was concerned with Modest Mouse. I just kind of found them on my own, and a band called Creeper Lagoon opened for them, I'm trying to think. Yeah, Creeper Lagoon, they were okay. They're from San Francisco, kind of non-memorable. But anyway, I remember thinking of Isaac Brock, like, not thinking he could play at all and not thinking he could sing. Like, he was just super sloppy. But I remember the rhythm section, and that was Eric Judy and Jeremiah Green. And they had this, and there was an extra, like, drummer holding a snare around his neck. You can actually see some of that footage on YouTube, I believe. At least it's the same era. And they just had that club pulsing like a fucking, like a dance hall. And it was like disco, but it was indie rock, you know? I'd never seen anything like it, and it totally blew me away. Like, I didn't think these guys could play. I kind of came from St. Augustine, where it was like a lot of dudes could play like standardly well, you know? What I mean by that is they could actually play like scales and, you know, classic band formations. Modest Mouse had none of that. They didn't have your 1-5 bass line. It was all just thrown together, but it was totally unbelievable. It was noisy, and it just fucking floored me. It was so goddamn good. And I remember the song Dark Center of the Universe. They had a very early version of that. anyway, I went and bought Lonesome Crowded West, went to my fucking... Oh, you got to understand one thing about Isaac Brock's playing style. I didn't like his style at the time. I learned to like it over time. But basically, it was like bendy. He had this old piece of crap blue guitar. It was like called a Marlboro or something, I remember. And it had a whammy bar. And that's the little piece that's down by where your picking hand is. And you kind of hit... He would hit these harmonics and he would bend them. And I think he kind of learned it from the Talking Heads a little bit, although the Talking Heads, I think, did it with a keyboard. But he somehow learned how to play this way. And I don't remember that night, but later I would watch Modest Mouse a lot live. And the reason why I'm telling you about Modest Mouse and I'm starting this story is because I really tried to play like that dude at some point. Like, it's ironic that I didn't think he could play very well, but I just didn't get it at the time. You know, it was too unorthodox. Now we all know that he's a brilliant lyricist, brilliant guitar player and all that stuff. But at the time it wasn't apparent to me. But then I would see them around and I had this little Gibson 330 guitar and I could kind of do the same thing with my guitar as Isaac Brock could do. I didn't have the whammy bar, but I had strings between like the bridge or whatever and the end of the guitar, and I could like hit a harmonic and bow, wow. And so I did it a lot. And nobody knew where it was coming from. I was just ripping Isaac Brock off, basically, you know, for better or for worse. But I would do it in my band, and people thought it was great, right? But then me and my drummer of the time, the band, ended up going to see Modest Mouse, and he said, "You better not do that anymore, man." You know, I said, "Fair enough." And I don't know. I mean, I never made that part of my playing simply because it wasn't mine, you know. But I was very influenced by Isaac Brock as a guitar player. I remember writing a song called Disco Rodeo or something. But anyway, that's all a blur kind of. That's like Room 11 stuff. And I think what sprung out of that, most importantly, is I met this guy named Jeremy Charbonneau. And Jeremy's probably listening. What's up, man? Me and Jeremy, he's definitely like a very, you know, kind of integral musical partner for me. I think he was at a Room 11 show at possibly the Monkey Pub in the University District. Little tiny hole in the wall. My buddy DJ Demas, God rest his soul, booked us because I worked at Time Life Libraries with a bunch of people who had crystal meth and stayed up all night and dialed their asses off and sold Sounds of the 70s and serial killer documentary books and... I don't know, country music CDs, and you know, all that Time Life stuff. Ancient Mysteries or Unsolved Mysteries or something? You know, the big like fake black leather books. We sold all that stuff. Anyway, I got the gig. The Monkey Pub played with Room 11. That was my buddy Aaron Krantz. That was Autumn. That was Jen. Anyway, I met Jeremy at one of these shows, and somehow Room 11 broke up, basically because it was just totally debaucherous and a crazy fucking band, and we were too chaotic and unfocused to even get demos together. So whatever, it was a fun time, and people remember that fondly. But at some point, it dissolved, and I started jamming with Jeremy, and I remember putting my arm around him and walking and being like, "We should start a band, dude." It was kind of a moment, I guess. I don't know if he remembers that. And he agreed. And, you know, he could deal with my personality. And I don't know. We were a lot younger then. You know, I think as we get older, we get a little bit more eccentric and strange. But back then, we were probably just pretty damn normal. I don't know. Do I consider myself normal now? Possibly. But I've been told that I've gotten eccentric over the years. I think my personality has strengthened, and I have views that I believe in now, and I never did. So maybe that's what people mean by eccentric. Like, that's crazy, man. You're saying that crazy shit, politically speaking, usually, but we won't get into that. Anyway, Jeremy and I started a band called, he named it called $5 Tip. And $5 Tip was just me and him. We played a handful of shows. And then, what the hell? We played a handful of shows. I remember, I would knock over my amp and I broke my guitar. It was a really expensive guitar. Oh, that's right. $5 tip. That's what it was. $5 tip turned into Hiram Figg. Now, Hiram Figg was Jeremy and I, and then this guy Marty joined. Now, Marty's a great dude. Marty's, he's a crazy dude. Got in some trouble lately, but almost went to jail for like half his life. Anyway, he joined the band, and we had some pretty good music. We went on tour down to California. Those are really cool fucking memories, actually. That was called Hiram Figg. We brought our own little demos. We just handmade demos, like 30 or 40 handmade, hand-printed, everything. Little demos. We had them to sell, and we had a couple of really great gigs. The only problem was, like, Marty and Jeremy never really got along. They never did, ever. I was always kind of the diplomat, and that's how it went. At one point, Jeremy was talking to a girl, and Marty was, like, massaging this chick while Jeremy was trying to talk to her or something, pissed Jeremy off. I don't know. It was just bad. That was down in California. And Marty's just, I don't know, man. He's a phenomenal dude, but in that situation, I just think he was trying to be the alpha or something like that. Anyway, at one point, Jeremy just didn't show up to a show, and he left a pretty classic note. He was like, I will not be playing. Marty made us late, basically, to this show, and Jeremy was pissed, and rightfully so. I mean, it wasn't the first time, and a lot of things had just added up and added up, and Jeremy said, I will not be playing the show tonight. You will find me at home. I said, well, that kind of sucks, but that's pretty ballsy. Just leave a note like that and not show up. Anyway, we went and did this show at the Showbox in Seattle. And it was just me and Marty, I think. Yeah, and we got a surrogate drummer that night. It's a guy named Rob Femer. And he's actually kind of made a name for himself. He's a DJ, and he's in a band called the Femers. But he played drums for us, and I didn't realize at the time that he played guitar and sang. Because he was in a band called Cabrini Green, I think, that was playing that night with my buddy Aaron, who was previously in Room 11 with us. I played an REM song, It's the End of This Band as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. And that was it. Like, that was the last show. Me and Marty never really reconvened. I think at some point we all got together for a brief amount of time, but it got weird again. It got weird again between Jeremy and Marty, and I think somebody walked out. You know, it just, whatever. But anyway, that dissolved, and I wanted to go solo. That was my big plan. I was going to go solo. What the fuck does that mean? My buddy Kelly at the time, who's not really my friend anymore, would say, like, solo, like fucking Phil Collins. Like, he's making fun of me. I was like, well, yeah, I just want to, like, control shit, and if people come and go, I don't want to. That's one thing about bands. It's kind of weird. Like when you're in a position like me, on one hand, I love the idea of a band. You know, I love the idea, like four dudes, girls, whatever, you know, five dudes, three, stick, you know, the thick and thin. Now, the thing is, I'm not stick together, you know, through thick and thin. I'm not a super prolific person with my songwriting. Lately, I have been. The last couple of years, I've written a lot of songs, it's easier for me now. But I don't know if I'd call it writer's block or just get scared to do it. But the thing is, when you don't have a lot of material, and you give the material to a certain project, and that's all your material, if the band breaks up and you have to write a whole new record or something, all that material is just kind of gone. So the idea was to basically be my own band and call it Jesse Boggs, but then get people around me. And if they came and went, oh, well, it's still my songs. I can keep it. No hard feelings. Anyway, me and Jeremy played under Jesse Boggs for a while, and we got a trumpet player, and I think I was influenced by Neutral Milk Hotel and Bright Eyes. I love Bright Eyes and all that shit. And Saddle Creek Records, great record label. Connor Oberst is phenomenal. He's the singer of Bright Eyes, and I got to see him play with Bright Eyes on a Tuesday night in Seattle at the Paradox on University Avenue. And He's famous now, but at the time, I just loved that record, Fevers and Mirrors. It's one of my all-time favorite records. Beautiful lyrics, unbelievably talented dude. And he was young. He was like 20 years old, and I couldn't believe it. I was like 24 or something at the time. Here's this 20-year-old kid just writing world-class songs, and we went to see him, and he lit up the room. It was great. I got to say hi, and he was so young. Like, Conor Oberst was so young. I said, hey, man, this song, it's, I forget the name of it, but the catchy part is called, like, While the Wolves Are Away, and I shook his hand. I said, it's an amazing song, and he just seemed so giddy. He was just a kid, and he was just loving it. I think he was just starting to realize that, indeed, his dream seemed to be coming true. At least that's what I got from my interaction with Conor. Anywho, me and Jeremy started Jesse Boggs, which is my name, which turned into J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction. It doesn't matter. At some point, we got acoustic. We went acoustic, and I got a trumpet player because I was influenced by all that Saddle Creek stuff. We were electric for a while. I don't know if that was $5 tip or if that was Jesse Boggs or what. Maybe we had a different name, but that's a long time ago. We're talking about 18 years ago or something. This is when it started to get good, though, that particular band. We got Charlie, great trumpet player. Then we got, he had like two buddies from college. He had a guy named BJ who played violin and Tony who played bass. And that was kind of the core of it. It was me, Jeremy, BJ, Charlie, and Tony. And it was like organic psychedelia. When you put a trumpet together with a violin, it's just unbelievable. It's an unbelievable sound. To me, it was. And it actually, I really found something with myself and music at that point. It was really being able to control that band and being able to, like, they were so talented. They could do their own thing, but I could also ask them to do things. And it was great. It was so cool. I think that's what it was. Yeah, before we got them, I started to record an EP without them. And then I formed the band around the EP. And yeah, that was called Crude Stew. And at the end of this, I'll play a song from Crude Stew. So stay tuned. Crude Stew was an EP that I put out under J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction. Did a tour on it. I even toured down to, like, Mexico and got to sing with a Beatles cover band. Like, I did an 18-date tour, and I brought a projector with me. And I would go show up to these venues, and I would project these, like, nature movies onto me, and I would play my songs. And it was kind of crazy, kind of cool, because people would often say, like, did you choreograph the projection with your songs? And I hadn't, but apparently it made some sense. People were like putting their, you know, people make sense out of chaos sometimes in their minds, some kind of coping mechanism. And it was great. Me and my girlfriend at the time's brother, he took me down. It was one car, one guitar. I think I had an amplifier, yeah. And I just played acoustic guitar and amplifier with a projection right on me in all these venues. And I ended up in San Diego, but then we went down to like Ensenada, Mexico. And I didn't play down there, but I remember there was a Beatles cover band, a Mexican Beatles cover band. And I asked them if I could sing with them. And they said yes. And they were, I picked Money by the Beatles somehow. And I sang it. And in my opinion, it was just like just the greatest moment. I love the Beatles. I was totally channeling John Lennon with this Mexican Beatles group. People seemed to think it was fun. I don't know. Maybe it was terrible. There's a very good chance that could be. I have very fond memories of it, though. So I'm getting it out of whack, but long story short, I formed a band after I made the EP, Crude Stew, and the band was like five people. Trumpet, violin, bass, myself, and drums. Jeremy was with us for a while. And I just loved the songs. I loved playing with that band. There was just such great harmony with everybody. It was so positive. And like there were some like Christian dudes. We would play like, we played the, what the fuck was it? We played all kind, mostly small places. Like in Ballard, we play little restaurants that had, you know, little stages and pianos, and but it was always really cool. And I ended up meeting, early on here, and this is, I met a guy named Eric Judy, and Eric Judy was in Modest Mouse, and I knew exactly who he was. Now, how I met Eric Judy was, I had been hitting open mics a lot, and I met a guy named Ben. Ben is no longer with us. Ben committed suicide a couple years ago. Jumped off the Aurora Bridge, I think, from what I heard. And Ben Miller is his name. Talented guy. He was in a band called Shoes for December. And they were like one of those things that if... Honestly, go check out Shoes for December on like iTunes. The record is called Falls Like Feathers, I believe, and Fall Like Feathers, and it's so beautiful. I feel like they could be like a posthumous indie rock hit. It was influenced by Modest Mouse, Elliott Smith, things like that, but he was so pretty, and the way he played was so gorgeous, and he was just like kind of a rugged guy, but like so sweet. Anyway, I ran into him in an open mic, and he was so open and friendly, he just said, I told him I'd booked a show somewhere else at one of the places, the open mics. And he said, well, could I get on that bill? I have a band called Shoes for December. And I said, okay. And then we show up and he said, oh, I invited my friend. And his friend was a guy named Joe Syverson, who is now in a band called like Giant Joe or something, or Joe Giant or something like that. Anyway, he's in a bunch of bands. But I was a little bit PO'd that he would just invite another band, but lo and behold, the dude brought Eric Judy, who was his roommate, Eric Judy, the Modest Mouse bass player. So I was just stoked. I mean, Modest Mouse was like my favorite band on earth, and here's the guy from Modest Mouse watching us, who I like totally known his bass lines, understood how great of a fucking bass player he was. And that was at the Old Town Ale House, yeah, in Ballard. And after the show, I had a little bit of a buzz on, and he certainly did, and Eric Judy came up and was like, I fucking love your band, dude. And it was just me, a trumpet player, and Jeremy. And hey, I'll take it, man. This guy was in Modest Mouse. He was telling me he loved his band. I exchanged numbers with him. It was like getting the number from the hottest chick, you know, in a bro way, you know, in a platonic manner. But we did a whole bunch of shows at J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction, all five of us. Now, Eric Judy did not actually... He did a show with us later, like one of the final shows, kind of, I think. But we just had this little following. We'd go, and people started showing up, and we had just such a good fucking time. And it was so harmonious and really, really honest and passionate reactions to our music. It was brilliant. Probably, to be honest, I would say definitely the greatest musical thing I had ever done. Was J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction. Now, we had a different drummer at some point. His name was John, and it was a different vibe, but it definitely worked as well. He was a little more jazzy, so we had to change it up a little bit. But, you know, we got used to his style, and it was very, very cool. He was a little bit of an older dude, kind of an odd fit. You know, he, like, at some point he had a rack. He had a rack for his drums. And if you're in an indie rock band back then, a rack. See, now I would kind of be like, that's fucking wild, dude. That's weird. That's rock in a weird way. Let's do it because it's strange. But back then it was like, dude, he has a fucking rack. Like, we can't play with a dude with a rack drum kit. That's just so metal. It's just not cool. It's like something the guy from Alice in Chains would do, or Rush or something. Or anyway, like, we made him change his rack. We made him just get stands for his drums. Kind of funny. Like, he's an older guy, like, good drummer. And, like, here's us younger people just being like, dude, fucking lose the rack, bro. But anyway, we played all over the Northwest, and it was just so great. J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction. But then, as all things do, things stop working. And not for me. I wish that band could have gone on. I had a breakup, so I was going through a real rough time, and it kind of came to an end after my breakup. But the first thing was like the trumpet player leaves and then the bass player leaves. And then you're trying to keep this chemistry with this band. And chemistries are so delicate. It's just people. It's just the way they interact with each other. You know, you see it in large bands like, I don't know, Guns N' Roses. You know, you could probably ask Axl Rose. He's played with a whole bunch of different versions of Guns N' Roses. But if he's being honest, I would 100% guarantee that he says that original lineup, you know, was the baddest, fucking awesomest thing. It happened organically, and you can never really recreate that. It's like lightning in a bottle. You really can't. I'm sure at the time he thought it was a great idea to kick out Steven Adler, but they never, ever recovered. They never, ever recovered. I saw Guns N' Roses twice in like 91 and 92. And I don't even consider that it was the real Guns N' Roses. I mean, everybody was there, but it was like Matt Sorum, you know. I know I'm making a stretch to talk about my band at the time, who didn't do anything aside from an EP and played a few tiny cool shows in Guns N' Roses, but it's the same thing. Once that initial chemistry starts to leaves because you switch members, generally it never comes back. Unless you're the Rolling Stones, they seem to change people. Occasionally it gets better. But it didn't in this case. We just kept trying to recreate the magic and all that. But while we had the magic, we lost our bass player. But Eric Judy from Modest Mouse, this is one of my greatest rock and roll memories, is he actually joined us and he played with us at the Crocodile. And I remember the dude just having such great tone and kind of being blown away at his tone and his musicality, but also thinking, wow, this guy doesn't even know notes. You know, Modest Mouse was so good, so original, so young when they started, so unorthodox that he didn't even know notes. And he said he was the most musically, theoretically minded person in Modest Mouse. And I couldn't even say like, hey, I couldn't tell him at the time, like, here's an E. No, I had to like show him. And literally I just showed him how to play all the bass parts, but his tone was so fucking good. It worked so well. And me and him actually wrote a song that we played with the band at the Crocodile. And if you're interested in hearing that, you actually can. I didn't record it, but at the time, at the Crocodile basically recorded for like 10 years or something. It was this big project for the University of Washington. They recorded thousands and thousands and thousands of rock shows. And if you go to the archives in the University of Washington and look up J. Hiram Boggs, I know you're going to get right on this. I'm really sure. But you look up J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction, you'll see us play the Crocodile a whole bunch. One of those times is with Eric Judy. And we wrote a song, and it was basically like a Modest Mouse song with me strumming along the chords. And it never made it onto a Modest Mouse record, to my knowledge. But I was so stoked. You know, here I am, like, creating with one of the main creators in Modest Mouse. And, wow, talk about a fucking awesome experience. Yeah, he was a good friend for a while. I still know him as an acquaintance. It's just kind of when you're, I don't know, when you're friends with people that are kind of famous, it can get kind of weird for both parties, you know? Because what, you know, friendships are based on like regular friendships are just, it's not opportunism or anything. And I didn't look at him as an opportunistic thing, but I kind of would feel weird when I would call him, like I was being weird, you know, like the, just nervous or something. And at some point I just like backed off, and who knows, we kind of quit talking though at some point, but it was so fucking cool. I digress. It gets better before it gets to that point. At some point everybody was stoked on my group, at least my little tiny circle of people, and the little circle of people in Modest Mouse that I knew the group. And I got to play Eric Judy's wedding, and Isaac Brock was there like watching the band. And I told him sorry for ripping him off. And he said like, oh, I've ripped off everybody. Don't fucking worry about it. You know, and there was a cake with dog shit icing, and it was like late at night, and I got to serve Isaac Brock some fucking dog shit looking ice or cake, you know. And all the really cool memories. I got really drunk that night, and he made sure none of us drove home drunk. But yeah, I got paid like $500 for playing Eric's wedding. I mean, how fucking cool is that? I would have done it for free, but I think I was trying to put out my EP, so I took the money. The Crude Stew EP, and at the very end of this, I'll play you a song. Anyway, at some point, I made it vocalized, and this is when I realized kind of like, if you want the universe to react, if you want to do something, you have to say it. You have to fucking say it. Now, you don't talk about your artistic projects and your endeavors and your great ideas. You don't talk about those things in the early stages. But if you want something to happen, you can say that to the universe, and sometimes they respond. And I remember telling a friend, I want to open for Modest Mouse, and they go, I think you can, man. It just, and then I got a call, you know, at my work from Eric saying, hey, would you guys like to open up for us? And we said, hell yeah. We had to do it on the all ages night, which wasn't the cooler of the two nights because there was already a band, but that's the only night we could do it. To be honest, it would have been better the other night because we were like running fucking hot. It sounded good. And who knows where it would have taken us. But anyway, we got to open for Modest Mouse at the Showbox in Seattle, and it was sold out. We got paid $100. Honestly, I probably could have gotten paid more, and nobody would have sweated it, but I would have done that for free as well. It was a snowy night, and wow, yeah. I can still kind of remember accidentally almost stealing Isaac Brock's guitar pedal. I remember asking him for a guitar pick, and he told me he had hot sauce. I remember the crowd going nuts when we played. I remember being totally stoked on everything about that night. I remember getting laid after the show by my girlfriend. I remember people that never saw Modest Mouse saying that we were so much better, which is funny, right? It's cool. The problem was I recorded a record, then the band got really good, and I never recorded with that band. And so I think that was probably the apex of it when we opened for Modest Mouse. And just, it's one of those great memories. I used to tell her, for years, I told everybody about it. Like, I'd meet somebody and just tell them about it. That's how much of an asshole I was, you know. Anyway, so that's it, guys. That's like, it's a whole bunch of information, but there you go. That's like this, I'm going to have a third chapter. And the third chapter is going to talk about another project with awesome Jeremy Charbonneau, the drummer. And that's called Smile Brigade. We'll talk about Smile Brigade in our next Jesse Music Seattle situation. I want to play you guys a song right now. It's off Crude Stew, the EP. It's called Ashes and Graves. It's one of my better songs. It's a little slow. There's no violin on it, but there is that trumpet on there. So you can kind of get a vibe of what that band was a little bit like. Cool little shuffle beat by Jeremy Charbonneau. I think a guy named Tony Ignacio played bass. Charlie played trumpet. And I sang, played acoustic guitar. Is that everybody? Jeremy on drums, Tony, Charlie, myself. Yeah, that's it. Hey, thanks guys for tuning in. Look, next week I'm going to have a guy named Dave Kiernan on. He's an awesome dude. It's going to be called Dave Eats Crow or Dave Eats Shit. He predicted that the Democrats would not win the House. They obviously won the House. But now there's a lot of strange stuff going on, man. A lot of strange stuff. Like votes being, you know, trucked in, and like they're all Democratic, and now the Democrats are all winning more and more seats, so it looks like a slow blue wave. But people are like, what the fuck's up, Broward County? Anyway, that's next week with the Shit Show with Jabo. Thanks for listening here with my meandering fucking thoughts about a long time ago and my music. Hopefully there's something of value in there. You guys found it entertaining. Hopefully you got through the whole thing. Either way, here's a song by J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction. This is released in about 2000, 2002, maybe 2003, perhaps. It's off an EP called Crude Stew. If you like it and you want a copy, I can send you a copy. I can sign it. Just hit me up. Just send me a message. TSS with J-Bo. Google it. I'm on Podomatic. I'm on iTunes. Give us a 5-star review if you liked it. Find us. Hit me up. I'll send you a copy. All right. Hey, take care, everybody. This is J-Bo with the Shit Show at J-Bo. We shall talk soon. This is Ashes and Graves by J. Hiram Boggs and Satisfaction. See ya.